Session number 27341, Reel 2.
John Maybank, Reel 2. So, how long were you roughly at St Vincent for?
I think 2 months. May have been 3 months. December, yes. That's right, about 3 months it must have been. About 12 weeks.
And you think at that stage, obviously, you were ready for flying training, so would that probably have been the stage?
Yes, we passed out at St Vincent, and we were promoted to be leading airmen, acting leading airmen, rather than naval airmen second class. And we wore a red hook on our arms, which we had to sew on. And then we were given, I think it was at that stage, we were given all our flying equipment. And that consisted of a Sidcut flying suit, quite a heavy thing, a lightweight, horrible flying overall, not like the American thing, it was a baggy mess. I've got a picture of me in it, I think, somewhere. And then we had the Mae West goggles, helmet, boots, beautiful sheepskin boots, a sheepskin flying jacket, which was a beautiful garment. Watch.
Did you get your logbook at that stage as well?
Yeah. I'm not sure whether we got the logbook then. I think we got the logbook when we got to Sealand. Because from then, when we got to Sealand, we were definitely under flying. And at Sealand, which was an RAF aerodrome near Chester, there was a Commander Hawkins, who was the senior naval officer, and he was our, if you like, our boss. He organized the courses and was in charge of our training. We were trained largely by RAF instructors. I think there was the occasional naval chap there, but basically all the flying training was RAF.
And these instructors, were they resting for operational?
Yeah, talk? There was a squadron leader Urquhart and a sergeant, later warrant officer Gadd, who were my main instructors. Nice men. And I enjoyed the flying training. I thought it was marvellous. Sure.
What was the airfield like? What was it?
It was grass. It was a grass airfield. And we used to have the Nappy arrive with their little green hut on wheels, where we used to be able to get a cup of tea. And they were always in attendance. It's funny. And whilst we were at Sealand, the food was incredibly good. They had private caterers. And there was always a hot meal or a cold meal. And it was invariably lamb, a big chunk of lamb, a great big saddle of beef, and you could have a slice, you could have as much as you like. We were fed like fighting cocks at Sealand. I've never had food like it. I know, it was wonderful. And I mean, that's what I recall Sealand, largely for that. And Frenzy, the tune that was, which was the flavour of the day, which I bought a record of, and used to play it endlessly, Frenzy, Artie Shaw. And it was just one of those great sort of moments in our lives of where we were living as youngsters and doing the things that we started to, we were wanting to do. And exciting beyond belief, and it was just great.
What aircraft were you learning to fly?
Tiger Moths.
Could you give me kind of a thumbnail sketch of what the Tiger Moth looks like and how it...
Well, it's a biplane. It's a tiny biplane. It's very light. It was it had a De Havilland, I think a Gypsy Major engine. It was, I think so. It was very light, very responsive. You start with, we were taken up for a flight just to sort of familiarize ourselves with the aircraft by the instructor to begin with. And did a few circuits and bumps just to get, which is around the airfield. And it was a thrill. It was absolutely thrilling. And of course, terribly exciting. And so they didn't let us handle it to begin with. I may have put my hand on the stick just to get a feel for it. But the second time we went up, we were started to train, and they made us handle the plane and feel it and get to go it. And again, we were just doing circuits and bumps. And the whole idea was to get us used to landing and taking off, landing and taking off, landing and taking off. And doing the circuit in a routine way, which followed custom and which we had to do so that when we're on our own, we knew exactly what we were doing. So we did a lot of circuits and bumps. And then after a day or two of this, we then, you know, went out further into the countryside, and it was amazing to me because I couldn't recognize anything. Now, strange enough, New Zealand, I'd been in the air a couple of times, but I knew where I was in New Zealand. I knew the hills, I knew the valleys, but in England, the countryside was incredible because it was all little fields. And also, you had a lot of inversion. You know what an inversion is? Well, it's pollution in the air. And you had to get up to many times as high as 9,000 feet to come free of it. Of course, when you're looking down through an inversion, you can only see the ground immediately underneath you, because if you're looking through at an angle, it's just a haze. So you had to learn where you were and learn quickly, because after about, I think it was about 9 or 10 hours, I soloed, and that meant that I was able to go off on my own.
One of the things that you must have learned in that early stages was how to taxi the Tiger Moth. Taxi the Tiger Moth.
Taxi it? Yeah. Well, you had to do it with the engine, because there were no brakes. And that, of course, was... Well, you soon learned it, because if you'd never flown an aeroplane before, you'd never flown with brakes. So you had to learn that it was all done by the engine. And it was straightforward enough after a while.
What were the things that you were learning, obviously, in that first period before you soloed? What were the types of manoeuvres that they were...
Well, to start with, you did, it says here, familiarity with cockpit layout, preparations for flight, and air experience, 15 minutes, you see. That was my very first flight with this fellow, or it was with the flight lieutenant, Stocken. And then we did effective controls, taxiing, which is where you learn how to make the thing turn. So it was awfully difficult to start with to make a Tiger Moth do anything more than either go in a circle or to go anything other than the way it wanted to go.
Is there a technique for taxiing then? Because obviously it must have quite a high, slightly high nose.
You have to get your tail rudder, and the wind over the rudder would actually turn the aircraft. That was the only thing that you had. So, you know, you had your right foot down if you wanted to go to the right. To the right, yes, that's right. Yes. And your left foot down if you want to go to the left. So, and you open the engine up fast if you wanted to make a turn.
You also mentioned familiarisation with the cockpit. I imagine the cockpit in the Tiger Moth is relatively basic.
Oh, gosh, yes. There are only about 3 or 4 instruments. Altimeter, speedometer, turn and bank indicator, oil pressure. That was about it. And then the petrol tank was sitting above your head. And I think it had a little glass indicator of what of how much fuel was in it. I think there was something like that that told you whether your petrol was was running out. But that sort of thing, straight and level flight, came on my third flight, you know. Well, no, it wasn't, second flight. And that was a 40 minutes, and that was dual control.
To somebody who's never flown a biplane or a propeller, what's the technique literally just to keep it on straight and level?
Actually, the strange thing about Tiger Moth was that it was so delicate. Every little gust of wind, or any wind at all from any direction, would cause it to drift. You had to, very often, you'd be crabbing along to stay on a line because of the wind. It was so light and so affected by the weather, and high winds were extraordinarily difficult to fly in.
So was your training affected at all by the weather?
Oh yes, because if it was a bad day, you didn't fly. But we were flying in Sealand in the summer months. You know, we were there from May. See, I got here May the 27th, 1943. Is that the first flight? Yes, I think it was May the 27th, 1943.
So you were saying when you soloed, what was the procedure for soloing?
For soloing?
Yeah.
Let's see if I can find the date of the record of it. Yes, June the 17th was my solo day, and no, it wasn't. It was June the 11th, first solo. There we are, written down large and underlined in red. Great thrill. What the routine was that you were. You were tested by a senior instructor, and I noticed that Flight Lieutenant Rogers took me off for an assessment test number 2. So I must have had a first assessment. Yes, I'd held on June the 5th, I had a first assessment by this man Rogers, and he gave me another one a week later. And it was following that I had another test called Test 1 with a flying officer, Dean, and went solo after that. So all on the 11th of June. I must have passed those two tests to allow me to do it. And it was a great thrill because suddenly I was there all on my own and frightened stiff, actually. But I just sort of thought, well, I'll just do it. And opened the throttle and took off in a bit of a sort of crab across the airfield. but got airborne all right. I was terrified of actually the propeller hitting the ground. I don't know why. So I probably took off at a slight sort of upward inclination and did one circuit and then landed. And it was no trouble at all. And I just seemed to remember what I'd been taught, because it concentrates the mind wonderfully to be in a sort of situation like that. And as long as you don't panic, you're all right. You're too thrilled to be panicking anyway. It was not that sort of situation. It was very interesting and a great thing to do. And the Tiger Moth was a beautiful airplane to fly. And of course, I grew to love it. I did about 80 hours in it, I think, altogether, something of that order. And I thought it was a heavenly thing. And I reckon anybody with a sense of balance could fly a Tiger Moth. There she is there.
What happened after the soloing? Was there a different tempo to the training?
Yes, it became much more intensive because we had to fly and learn to handle the airplane. And at the same time, we had to do navigation as well, which entailed cross-country flying. And of course, that was that was a difficult thing, because to learn the English countryside, if you're born here, you sort of, you know it. But to me, it was totally alien, strange. Eventually, I did I did solo cross country, and I was told to go to, I think it was Burslem or something like that. Stoke-on-Trent.
Elmstone.
Yes, Stoke-on-Trent. Fly to Stoke-on-Trent. Take a note of what you see, and then change course and go down to Elmden, which is in Birmingham, and land there and report to the flight tower. And so I took off, and I didn't know what I had to look for, but I had to make a report of what I saw at Stoke-on-Trent. Well, when I got to Stoke-on-Trent, I realised what I'd been looking for, what I had to look for, because the place was just a stack of a whole raft of chimneys belching smoke and flame. And, of course, it was the potteries, and it was quite incredible. And it was like the mouth of hell as far as I was concerned. I'd never seen anything like this. We didn't have industry in New Zealand. You know, we're all cowcockies over there and sheep farmers. So that heartened me enormously, because I realised I'd arrived at the right spot, so my navigation was all right. So I then turned on course and went off down to it, and I'd had to plot my own navigation course, you see, my own flight. And then I turned on course and went down to Elmden, and I found that airfield and landed, and I reported to the big tower there where you go and report to the flying officer who's in charge. And they signed my chitty, and then I came back, got in the aircraft again, and flew off back to Sealand. And that was all quite simple, it seemed to me at the time, although it was a huge undertaking to go off on your own, you know, because now and again people would get lost and land in fields and crash and do all sorts of silly things. But fortunately, mine was all right. And then we did some night flying as well, I noticed. In July we did a bit of night flying, and that was horrendous stuff. But I was night flying with an instructor. I don't think I ever did any night flying on my own in a tiger moth. That would have been hairy.
With the night flying, there must be very few visual points of reference.
Well, that's right. It was blackout. That's right. Well, I did an hour altogether. I think that was the only night flying that I did, and it was all in red ink, so it must have been considered something special. But I did two flights on one night with two instructors.
I imagine it's quite important to be able to trust your instruments during the night flight.
You have to. This is the whole thing about night flying, I suppose. Certainly on a fighter aircraft, it was all instrument flying, because you had to keep your nose over the side as well, because you were looking out for the flare path, to line up on the flare path. And of course that was shielded all the way around the circuit, except when you were landing. And and there were tiny lights during the war years, so, you know, it was not easy.
And how easy is it initially to trust your instruments?
You're taught right from the word go that the instruments were absolutely vital. And when you're a young person, you believe what you hear. I know that sounds daft, but you do. You believe that you can trust them. And I did. And I had no problem with instrument flying at all. I found it very... because I gave myself over to it and accepted it, and didn't allow my senses to overrule my conscious thinking. I was able to do instrument flying quite well I didn't have any problems with. Most people who had difficulty was that they couldn't believe what they were reading. And I think that's where... there is always a moment or two of panic when you start to do it, because you're very concerned that you can't see where you are. And that is a bit horrifying. But, you know, you've got a bloke in front, he wants to get home just as much as you do, so you eventually realise that he's not going to pray. And you just give yourself over to it. And it was really quite... I found it quite good. It was quite interesting, the instrument flying.
At that stage, did you do any kind of basic aerobatics as well?
I can't recall that I did any without under a hood. I think not on a tiger moth. I did a lot of aerobatics myself, you know, and was trained to do aerobatics. And of course, it's a very responsive little aeroplane. We'd heard about gremlins, you know, these things that are supposed to frighten pilots. And I swore I saw gremlins, because on one occasion I did a... what I tried to do was a roll off the top. And I dived down and pulled the nose up, and I got it up standing vertically, and the aircraft decided they didn't want to go over the top, and it slid backwards. And stalled, you see. And all the crap that was in the bottom of the airplane came up and flew past me. I wonder what the hell are all the gremlins? Anyway, it dropped down, and I was a bit close to the earth, so I gave myself a bit of a fright, so I didn't try that again. But I was able to do these things. But you have to get up quite high, because you take up a lot of sky when you're aerobatting. And a tiger moth is a very forgiving aeroplane, however, you know, you have a hell of a job to prang one. But I did have an accident on a tiger moth. I landed on top of another tiger moth. There was somebody coming, I had an instructor with me, otherwise I might have been in real trouble. But I was coming in on a normal approach landing, you know, which is a sort of 45 degree landing, and there was another chap underneath who'd been doing a low-level landing, which is a powered landing, you see. With a tiger moth, you just sort of blip the engine occasionally as you're coming down, just to get keep your control. But it's a glide approach, really, as much as anything, a normal approach. And I leveled out. And found that I'd leveled out and hit something which I thought was the ground. I realized I was way above the ground. And I'd landed straight on top of the top plane of another tiger moth. And I'd put two dents into the wing on either side of the petrol tank. And here's my propeller going around, and his propeller going around, and I bounced off. Ooh, I tell you. Well, he was on the ground, so I bounced off a firm object, you see, but there were certainly a couple of dents in the thing. I bounced off and went round again and landed, and the instructor was a bit white-faced, and I was frightened stiff, because I realised what had happened, and so we landed, and they didn't say anything to me. I think he probably got a bit of a telling.
I was going to say, was it... Because obviously that would surely be the instructor's...
Yes, but you know, there's a blind spot on all aeroplanes, and there was a blind spot with us, because you can only peer so far over the side. You're not that much... You're quite deep in the cockpit of a tiger moth. And to actually get your neck over and look straight down, quite difficult. You can look at an angle, but if another plane is behind you, which it would have been when we were making our approach. Wherever we were, it may have been slightly in front of us, I don't know, but whenever, we couldn't see it, and I didn't spot it, and he didn't spot it. So it must have been directly and stayed like that, because you're looking around all the time. You're very... I mean, there were 30 or so of us, or more, 40 of us flying. I think we were split up into two, morning and afternoon. So some did it in the morning and some did it in the afternoon. Or we did flying in the morning and ground subjects in the afternoon. But whatever it was, I think that there was a flight flying all... The flying was going on all day.
And what positions in the aircraft did you and the instructor have?
What position?
Would he sit behind you or would he sit in front?
No, you sit in front as the pupil. The instructor was sitting behind us. And... it's the other way around, isn't it? That's right, it's the other way around. I can't remember really. Doesn't matter. I know that you get into the front cockpit. That's right, the front cockpit when you do your solo, and so you've got nothing in front of you, no heads or anything.
And one of the things for people who don't fly that is most terrifying is the idea of spinning aircraft.
Yes, well, spinning and doing aerobatics, you had to learn to do this because this is the only way you're going to learn how to get out of a difficult situation in the event of an accident or in combat. I mean, you know, you had to learn to handle that aeroplane under every possible circumstance and condition that you might find yourself. And the little tiger moth was so responsive, and it would do anything really, and it spun just like a leaf, you know. And you could do flat spins, you could nose spins, and it would just tumble out of the sky, but in a fluttery sort of way. It was a lovely aeroplane. It was a delightful aeroplane to fly. And we all loved it in the end. You know, to begin with, you're very heavy-handed with a thing, and it's difficult, but not that bad.
Does it just need a light response?
Just a finger. You could do it with your fingertips, literally. And in the end, although you may have been gripping it, you're gripping it with just your tips of fingers. It was so gentle. And you never really needed to be ham-fisted with a tiger moth. It would turn. You could roll. You always did a sort of barrel roll with a tiger moth because the wings sort of took it into a great big arc. But it was a beautiful aeroplane to fly.
That sounds to me very much like getting the feel for an aircraft.
Yes.
Are there people who couldn't do that?
Yes, and of course they dipped. It was called dipped, which meant that you're taken off the course. But there were a few, not that many, strangely enough. I mean, I suppose those who were marginal were, and some of those who dipped were not able to take the flying. They had something physically wrong with themselves, caused them to stop flying. Some people became nauseous, sick all the time. That was pretty rare. But other people had found that they had problems with their ears, painful ears and things, and they had to go off and have medical work done on them. They tried to get everybody through, but there were people who were quite incapable of managing the flying game, and they simply just dropped away.
But some of them just lacked the coordination to do the hand and the feet and the...
Yes. Well, the Tiger Moth was the one aeroplane that, of course, enabled you to learn all these necessary characteristics that a pilot must have, especially a fighter pilot or any sort of single aircraft, single engine aircraft, because all single engine aircraft in those days, even though the heavy Corsair, was still very light and responsive in the air, and you had to throw them about and learn to throw them about and not be bothered. You know, you were diving at maximum speed, and the damn thing was rattling and heaving itself, and you thought it's all going to break up. But you sort of did it, you know. You just had to do it.